how should sports-related concussion be managed?
Comparing symptoms and COVID virus loads in children and adults.
What's the cause of sudden cardiac death in people with HIV?
And does cooling people after sudden cardiac death improve their outcome?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since I just saw this morning that we've passed the 600,000 mark for deaths from COVID-19 here in the United States, and I would note that that's probably a vast underestimate, why don't we turn first to yours and JAMA Pediatrics, taking a look at SARS-CoV-2 infection. It's at adults.
And in fact, COVID-19 was the third leading cause of death in the United States in 2020. Only about 13% of those cases are reported in children. Nevertheless, we took drastic measures to try to reduce transmission by closing down many of the schools. Well, it's clear that kids oftentimes are the vector of transmission for many infectious diseases, things like the flu, for example. With regard to COVID, however, they're less likely oftentimes to be the culprit in terms of transmission. It actually starts in the community and then moves into the school rather than the other way around. What these investigators hypothesize is that perhaps there was a difference in the COVID virus load in kids as opposed to adults, and it may in fact correlate with symptoms. That is, the more symptoms you have, the more COVID virus you in fact may have. They analyzed more than 37,000 nasal swabs to identify 123 children and 432 adults with COVID infection. Now, they found that kids were less likely to be symptomatic. 62% of the children were symptomatic as opposed to 93% of the adults. Furthermore, the adults were likely to have more symptoms than the kids as well. And then finally, when looked at viral loads, the kids that were asymptomatic had lower viral loads than the ones that were symptomatic. And by the way, the same was true for adults. This may account for why kids are less likely to transmit disease than adults. They're more likely to be asymptomatic. They're more likely to have fewer symptoms. And that's associated with a lower viral load.
And this all translates, of course, into strategies for helping to reopen schools safely.
What the editorialist suggests is, well, closing school really doesn't change community transmission. But we know that there are measures, even in the midst of an increase in community transmission, we know there are ways to stop its spread in schools. Keeping kids in pods, isolation, wearing masks, washing their hands. On the flip side, when you do take kids and teach them virtually, there's social isolation, they get behind educationally, there are behavioral issues as well. In the overall long term, it seems better to open schools and to employ the measures I talked about rather than to close schools.
Are you guessing that things that we look like are going to have as permanent changes in the healthcare environment, and I mean specifically masking, do you think that that's the kind of thing that might actually be permanent in schools, especially elementary schools?
I don't think so. But I think as we roll out vaccination and as we get more of the adults in the schools vaccinated, kids from the age 11 up vaccinated, and we're doing studies now looking for those getting vaccinated 6 months of age and older. And I think that rolling out vaccines is a much more practical solution.
Yeah, I wonder about it, though, because I think we've seen these really dramatic drops in other things, common colds, influenza, and there's some benefits to wearing those things.
There are, but it's not just the mask wearing. It's also the other things that are happening at the same time.
Since we're talking about kids, let's turn to the BMJ. This is a comprehensive statement taking a look at sports-related concussion, and this is largely in kids. This is a big issue, something that we've talked about so many times in the past. And a truly impressive number of organizations come together to create this consensus guideline on, all right, how do we define it and what are we going to do about it? So they define this sports-related concussion as a traumatic brain injury. It usually is of rapid onset and it has a functional disturbance rather than a structural injury associated with it. And frequently may have a range of clinical symptoms that do not necessarily involve a loss of consciousness. From high school injury surveillance systems, there's an estimated 1 to 1.8 million of these that take place each year in the United States in the age range of 0 to 18 years. Rugby, American football, ice hockey, soccer, wrestling, and lacrosse are the ones that have the highest incidence of concussions. As we've seen foreshadowed in other research, female athletes are more subject to developing a sports-related concussion than male athletes. This sports-related concussion is higher in those with a previous history of having had one, but also in those with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and or learning disabilities. They do make an assertion in these guidelines that this is not necessarily associated with any long-term negative impact. And I'm not sure I agree with that. And I'm not sure how they make that assertion. What are your thoughts?
I found several things that were surprising. One is there's no single test that makes a diagnosis. Imaging doesn't do it. There's not a biomarker. It's a clinical diagnosis. Number two is it doesn't lead to long-term sequela, particularly from chronic traumatic encephalopathy. They're saying that based upon the fact that there is no evidence to suggest that. I was surprised by one other thing, is that in the past, we thought, well, gosh, these people need to sit out for a couple weeks and not do anything. But they're saying just the opposite. The recovery is prolonged, or you're more likely to have persistent symptoms if you don't get back and begin to do at least some moderate physical activity under supervision.
Yeah, they also take a look at long-term effects, since you brought that up, and things that might happen at the time of injury that could predict that. But they also identify pre-existing mood disorder and high symptom load immediately after injury are the most consistent predictors of whether someone's going to have a long-term impact relative to their sports-related concussion. They say that there might be a place for neurocognitive testing if somebody does present with consistent symptoms after the injury.
And that's very rare. As you mentioned, there are 1 to 2 million of these reported each year, and that's probably an underestimate. But the number of individuals that have serious complications, if a person has immediate seizures or their loss of consciousness is more than brief, or they have persistent or recurring vomiting or severe or worsening headache, those things would prompt transfer to the hospital.
Okay, let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. Gosh, should we cool people after they have an MI or not?
There had been some conflicting information regarding whether this is beneficial. One of the initial studies suggested that whether a targeted temperature of 33 degrees, that's cooling someone down to about 91 degrees, was superior to keeping at a normal temperature, there was no benefit with regard to mortality. Subsequent smaller studies compared cooling to no regulation of their temperature, and in fact found that cooling seemed to be better. About a third or as many as a half of these individuals, as a result of their brain injury, will develop fever. So this study attempted to put this whole issue to rest. It compared hypothermia, inducing someone to a temperature of 91 degrees and keeping them there for about 24 hours with a very slow, gradual increase to normal temperature versus keeping them at normal temperature. They randomized 1,900 individuals with a coma. They had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Again, normal temperature versus cool temperature. And even those that needed a normal temperature, about a third of those needed some cooling device to keep them there. But when they evaluated the outcome at 6 months, the mortality was the same. They had the same eventual outcome and the same quality of life. So it's not as important to keep someone at 91 degrees, but it is important to make sure that they don't have a fever.
Talk to me about cooling somebody to that lower temperature. What are the downsides of doing that?
To get someone cool to that temperature, you usually do a couple of things. One is you can give them intravenous fluid that is cool. You can put surface things on them that are cool. And you can also give cool fluids via the GI tract. And when they looked at the side effects, individuals that were cooled here were more likely to have a significant hemodynamic compromise from an arrhythmia than those who were kept at normal temperature, which happened in about a fourth of the individuals.
And a lot more work. I'm such a fan of things that require less intervention rather than more intervention. Talk to me about the fever that's associated with this particular type of injury. What would you think is the genesis of that?
Probably some dysregulation in our thermoregulatory mechanisms. Not unusual for individuals on those circumstances to have difficulty regulating their temperature and they develop a fever.
Staying in the New England Journal of Medicine, let's turn to another population. And these are folks who have HIV. There's so much data that we're accumulating that when people are put on highly active antiretroviral therapy, they can expect a lifespan or enjoy a lifespan that's actually quite similar to someone who's not HIV positive. And so I thought this notion of sudden cardiac death among this population was kind of an interesting one. The authors say that this incidence of sudden cardiac death and sudden death caused by arrhythmia in people with HIV has not been clearly established. So they took a look at 610 unexpected deaths in HIV positive persons, and of those, 109 from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In looking at these really carefully, they found that the presumed sudden cardiac death occurred in 53.3 deaths per 100,000 person years in people with known HIV infection versus 23.7, so less than half deaths per 100,000 person years among those without known HIV infection. Sudden death caused by arrhythmias were 25 and 13.3 deaths per 100,000 person years respectively, so HIV positive, and again, about half among those without it. What I thought was really interesting was that a lot of these presumed sudden cardiac deaths were due to occult drug overdose. And that was way more common in the people with HIV infection than those without it, 34% versus 13%. When they took a look at the autopsies, they did note that they had this higher level of interstitial myocardial fibrosis than people without HIV infection.
Kind of an interesting study. It left me wanting more than knowing. So for example, the number of deaths was so small that the estimates of the incident rates are actually very imprecise. If you just did a comparison, it looked like that the rate of sudden death from arrhythmia among HIV positive persons was about 1.9 times higher than in non-HIV, but the numbers are so small, it wasn't statistically significant. So they said there really was no difference in arrhythmias, even though there's more fibrosis. It still didn't satisfy me as to what the cause was or whether there is an increased risk. I'm not surprised there's increased fibrosis. Fibrosis is the scar. Scar results from inflammation. We know that HIV itself is associated with inflammation, even in individuals taking highly active antiretroviral therapy. The fact that they couldn't correlate it with an increased incidence of arrhythmias is a little bit bothersome, because in most circumstances, it is.
It's sounding like you would say then that this study raises a lot of other questions that probably need a whole lot more data to answer.
It is. And I'm not sure we're going to get that. And it's just that there are a few individuals, either HIV positive or HIV negative, that have true sudden cardiac death.
Okay. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.